So we're here, we're kind of Corey Feldman fans. Can you tell us any stories about working with Corey Feldman on set?
Yeah, man. I mean, at the time, he was kind of the biggest person I had ever worked with or had the chance to work with. I mean, besides like a few interviews that I had done for other things, but not my own thing. I will say he showed up like with an entire entourage of like 30 people.
Nice.
And before he went inside, he has this bodyguard who's fully armed, right?
Oh my
Fully armed.
gosh.
Looks like a cross between like DMX and an NFL linebacker. And he's like 6'6", like jacked. He has like a muscle shirt on. And he literally like walks into this. We shot all Corey scenes in this like it's like a McMansion essentially. It's like a $2.5 million home in Studio City, California.
Crack open a cold box of wine or pour something cold on ice because it's the Binge Watchers podcast.
Tonight we're brought to you by Shudder.com. If you want to try Shudder, go to Shudder.com. You can try it free for 30 days. Go to Shudder.com and you're going to enter the promo code BINGEWATCHERS. Tonight we're actually joined by a horror movie director and writer, Edward Payson. Edward, what's up, man?
Nothing much, man. Trying to just be in this quarantine and not kill myself. So I think a lot of people are in that same boat.
Yeah, vicarious living, you know. Just watch a bunch of horror stuff and you'll get that energy out, you know. And it'll be all right.
One would think so, but I feel like my hips no longer exist. I've been sitting so much.
Oh, you just have you fused into your couch or your chair? Is that what you're saying? You just mutated into your chair there?
Yeah, I just get up and I feel like my legs are just like spaghetti.
Oh man,
I feel you. Yeah,
I definitely think like you have the imagination for the stuff that you're doing. That's for sure. If you're ready, we'll roll right into what we have to ask you, if you're cool with that.
Perfect.
All right, right on. So do you recall the first horror movie that you saw and why it had such a huge impact on you?
Yeah, the first horror movie I saw was actually by accident. When I was growing up, my parents got divorced really, really when I was really young, around 6 years old. And my dad, just like 15 months later, ended up remarrying and he lived across town. And I only saw him every other weekend. And he was actually a gunsmith of all things. So he'd make like bullets and weapons and had his own. Yeah. Had his own shop. And he, you know, he worked like pretty much 80 hours a week. So even when we were there, he would have to take a few hours and work and make some bullets for the Monday that we were going to be there or that he was going to be at work when we were there on the weekend. So one time I came down and he was watching Night of the Living Dead on like a 2x5 black and white TV. And he's like, oh no, you can watch this. Like, and I remember, you know, I was way too young. I was probably like 7 or 8 years old. And I was just like terrified for weeks. But then all of a sudden I got the bug and it became like this, you know, this taboo thing that like, every time I went to my dad's house, I was able to watch these movies I wasn't supposed to be watching. And I had a stepmom who was kind of like, kind of a bitch. Sorry if I can't swear on here. And she like didn't care about the rules at my actual house. So she like tried to implement her rules that she had with her kids, where it was like we could only watch G-rated films and stuff. I don't like any of this shit. So like my dad would literally send her out on like tasks by herself that he knew would take a long time so we could watch like Leprechaun and stuff like that. And he wasn't a total savage. He'd like fast forward through the nudity, but like all the violence and everything was fair game. So yeah, Night of the Living Dead kind of was the spark. And then from then on, I just really, really got into horror through high school. Was looking into all the obscure stuff. I worked at Hollywood Video. So like we got a lot of stuff that like I never, you know, just saw in my circle of friends. And from there, I just knew I wanted to make movies and it kind of sparked my interest.
Oh man. Did you say you worked at Hollywood Video?
Yeah, I worked at Hollywood Video for like 2 years, end of high school into first year of college.
Wow. I was a store manager in training at the old Blockbuster when I was going to film school. That was my, you know, that's how I got the, you know, could afford burritos back in the day. You know, so that's so funny. So, oh man, I can relate to that. I can also relate to like how you grew up and watched those movies. But if you had to narrow down your passion, if you could only choose one, and I know it's difficult, but if like it was just writing the scary movies or directing, you know, all the terror, what could you settle on one? And if so, which one?
I don't know if I could settle on one because, I mean, I'll tell you what I like. I like directing a lot more than I do writing. I hate writing. I hate it. I love having a finished script in front of me, but like it's so hard for me having like this ADD, like probably like 10-year-old's mind where I just want to do all this stuff and, you know, go all these places and do all these things to actually get myself to sit down and actually write is very, very hard for me to do. But, you know, directing just kind of comes like second nature to me where I just I love being around people. I love being around people that kind of share the passion and horror that I do. And I feel like if I was doing other movies, you don't really get that kind of camaraderie that you do with people that are kind of known in the horror game or known as horror actors or horror actresses. They kind of know like what they're in for, and that kind of like brings everything to a whole new level.
Also, getting that perspective, it sounds like you're talking about the journey almost. So what can you describe the road from going like from micro budget horror stuff to moving into like more mainstream?
Sure. Yeah. I still wouldn't to this day consider myself mainstream. I do have my biggest movie coming out, which is Bits, about a haunted Sega Genesis game. And nice. that one we got quite a bit more than I'm used to. All of a sudden, like, you know, on my typical set, my low budget sets, I rarely get a chair. And then, you know, I go to set first day here and they're like, oh, Mr. Payson, here's your trailer. We'll tell you when the set's ready for you. And I'm just like, wait, what?
what happened?
Yeah. But to answer your question, it just, I never took no for an answer. Even when I was supposed to be doing short films or people thought I wasn't like, experienced enough to be making films, feature films, I was doing it. So like my first feature film, it didn't really go anywhere besides a DVD off my website, which is now defunct. But we went to a bunch of festivals, and basically what my mindset was I'm not going to wait these 2 years in college to do all these general education requirements, and started making film with my friends on the weekends, a full 90-page feature film with 70 actors. It took like 2.5 years to make. But honestly, I wouldn't give it back for the world. Like, yeah, is it the best film? No, but I still talk to a lot of those people to this day. And honestly, like every single film from then on, when it comes to like budget and moving forward, it's all having to do with either people that I work with on past feature films or people that I work with on commercials, because that's kind of my day job is I'm a commercial director as well. And I've done like close to 300 commercials now.
Nice.
Thanks. Yeah. So like all these things, like kind of, I meet one person and they're like, oh, I know this person that's trying to get a horror movie off the ground. Or I know this person who has a budget, but they don't have a script. And it's kind of just, meeting all these people and making a good impression on all these people and being easy to work with, I think.
Nice. Hey, I'm Adam, by the way. I got the next couple questions.
Awesome.
So, tell us what Halloween Wars was really like behind the scenes.
Oh, it was pretty much a shit show for the most part.
yes.
So the rumors are true.
I love the honesty.
Yeah.
I was there season one, and in season one they really didn't know how the show was going to play out, and also it was like taking three shows they already had and just throwing them together for a Halloween special. And I think when I was there, if I remember correctly, they had four judges for the 4 weeks of Halloween, and three out of four of those judges dropped out last minute and they had to do like these replacements. they originally had like Michelle Trachtenberg. I don't know what she has to do with horror, but she was one of the judges. And they had like John Carpenter, and they had like a few others. But when I was there, the judges that we ended up getting were Rob Zombie once, R.L. Stine, Scout Taylor Compton, and then I think they brought back Rob Zombie again for a second time. And I actually had to go to the airport and pick up R.L. Stine in my little tiny car that was like full of like Taco Bell wrappers and stuff.
Yeah, it was
such a low budget show. They like shot in like Van Nuys, California, in like the crappiest studio ever. Like you go outside, it was like you're gonna get shot or stabbed. But yeah, man, it was a non-union show, and they just had us there, especially as a PA. I was there for like 12 hours a day with just a half-hour break, pretty much just going and picking up stuff and then coming back and cleaning the mess these people would make.
Nice. Bits sounds really fascinating. Just reading a little bit about it on IMDb earlier in the week. How'd you get such a great cast? Dominique Swain, Dee Wallace, both legends. I mean, you stack the deck here.
Yeah. Well, the way I wrote the script, I kind of wrote it so we could get as many small cameos as possible. Dee was one of the larger roles. Dominique Swain was a one day role, but we also got like James Duvall, who was the bunny in Donnie Darko. We got Bill Oberst Jr., who's kind of a big horror name and up and coming, and kind of like he's like the it guy these days. He'll do anything. It's so strange. Like he used to be a preacher, like a traveling preacher for like 15 years. Then all of a sudden, like says, I'm not only going to get into horror films. I'm going to be the guy that you know will show his penis in horror films and have it get bit off by a demon or something. Like,
I like this guy.
He's literally down for anything, and he's like the nicest guy in the world. But we got him. We got Najara Townsend from the Contracted series. But yeah, basically what we did was we were going to do all this ourselves. But then one of our producers had the idea to hire Jordan Bass Casting, and they kind of made all the calls, and we just kind of had to pay the paychecks, and that's kind of how that happened. But Dee Wallace actually wasn't even involved with the film at first. We wanted her, but she wasn't available. We had to push shooting from our original dates because we just had some stuff that wasn't lined up yet as far as locations. And then the actress that we had that was there in front of Dee Wallace was Dee Dee Pfeiffer, who's Michelle Pfeiffer's sister, who was in some horror movies back in the 80s and 90s and stuff.
I remember her, yeah.
Yeah, she had some kind of like emergency where it was like a hospital emergency, and she had to drop out like literally 3 days before shooting. So we called back to see if, you know, for whatever reason, Dee was available, and the movie that she was on wasn't doing it anymore, and we ended up getting her on 3 days notice.
Wow.
And she shot with us for 4 or 5 days.
Wow. Movie magic.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the Sunday Night Slaughter. We know there was previously an Indiegogo release. What are you allowed or willing to tell us about the upcoming film?
I can tell you whatever. So, yeah, what happened with that was we started off way back in 2014. It was supposed to be like a web series, and we shot the first two episodes, then realized, like, hey, we have all this amazing equipment, and we have access to all these, like, you know, really talented people. And at that point, web series were kind of like, eh, like people weren't really caring about or watching web series anymore. It was all about just like short form 1 minute content on YouTube and stuff. So it was like, why don't I rework these and we do a feature anthology film? So I then spent about a year reworking and taking all these separate scripts that I had planned to do as separate episodes that had nothing to do with each other, and kind of like revamping them and making them so they all work together. And you'd see characters from one and another one and not know there were big characters in a later one and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of Easter eggs throughout it. And then decided, like, okay, let's shoot this thing. And we started shooting that in 2016. And again, it was one of those things where it was like, each episode pretty much had a different cast. So we then had to make sure all these people were available. We had a lot of favors we had to ask for because it wasn't the largest budget that we had available to us. It was a non-union film, so we were, you know, just kind of digging deep into our pockets, asking friends, asking friends who had big houses if we could use their houses, all that kind of stuff. And we eventually were able to shoot it, and now it's in post-production and should come out around the same time as Bits.
Amazing.
That's awesome. So this is Nick, by the way. I wanted to ask you, where did the idea come from?
The idea for the Sunday Night Slaughter specifically?
Yeah.
So I had all these scripts over the years from like way back all the way to, you know, 2004, just short films that I had never done anything with that I either wanted to do something with but I couldn't afford it, or they just kind of fell by the wayside because I started working on other things, other people's things or something. And it actually happened when I was switching computers. I was going through all the stuff from my old computer that I wanted to save, and I just, you know, refound all these scripts, and I was like, whoa, let me do something with these. I'm not doing anything right now. So it kind of started there. That was kind of the spark of let's do a web series. And then that all evolved from there.
I love that you like went through an old computer. I've had that happen so many times. You're like, that was a really good idea, you know? So us here at Binge Watchers, especially me, we love anthologies. We just re-binged the Creepshow series, the movies, and the new series on Shudder. And I just have, this is a two-part question. What attracts you to directing and writing horror anthologies? And then do you have a favorite one that inspired you?
Yeah, I would say the one I was most inspired by is Trick or Treat. I love Creepshow and stuff, but I watched a double feature the first time. Like, I hadn't even seen Trick or Treat, but I saw it as a double feature with Creepshow at the New Beverly Cinema, which is like Tarantino's theater.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just love the rewatchability, especially with all the Easter eggs and stuff. I was like, I want to do that someday. And it just so happens, like, 4 years later, I decided to do it. So, or 4 or 5 years later, I decided to do it. What inspires me to do it? I mean, I wouldn't say I'll make a habit of doing it. All the other anthologies I've been a part of, I've just kind of contributed my short film into, like, a large anthology with a bunch of different filmmakers. That's kind of what happened with thesis film actually from college that I did nothing with except like showed on YouTube. That was just released as part of a trauma compilation called Grindsploitation 4 Meltsploitation. So all the films are about like melting and body horror and stuff.
Oh, I love that.
The itch, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're here, we're kind of Corey Feldman fans. Can you tell us any stories about working with Corey Feldman on set?
Yeah, man. I mean, at the time, he was kind of the biggest person I had ever worked with or had the chance to work with. I mean, besides like a few interviews that I had done for other things, but not my own thing. I will say he showed up like with an entire entourage of like 30 people.
Nice.
And before he went inside, he has this bodyguard who's fully armed, right? Fully armed. Looks like a cross between like DMX and an NFL linebacker. And he's like 6'6", like jacked. He has like a muscle shirt on. And he literally like walks into this. We shot all Corey scenes in this, like, it's like a McMansion essentially. It's like a $2.5 million home in Studio City, California. That's all like a smart house on the inside and everything. It's like clearly everything was on the up and up, but he like went in and acted like he was like a SWAT person, like going around the corners and everything. And I was like, yeah, dude, we are what we say we are. We've already given him the down payment. Like we're not, you know, bullshitting here. He's like, honestly, I'm just making sure it's not a birthday. Sometimes people will pay his day rate to have a Ninja Turtles birthday or something when he shows up.
That's great.
Oh my gosh.
So like he was great. Like he was a fruitarian, which we weren't told beforehand, so we had to send someone out to get all these like fancy fruits and stuff for him and his now wife, girlfriend at the time, to you know, just actually have something to eat and all that kind of stuff. But he was really cool. At the end of shooting, one of our nerdy producers brought a Goonies lunchbox and he like signed that, and then Then he got upset because he's like, I don't think they told me this product line was out and I should be getting royalties on this. And,
wow.
But no, he took pictures. He did like a little bit of publicity for us and stuff. And funny enough, in the movie, he plays a guy like a Chris Hansen type of person who catches sexual predators.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Appropriate.
Yeah. And then his documentary, his truth documentary just came out, right? Yeah.
Weirdly enough, before we shot, I knew nothing about any of that. Like, we didn't plan that. That was just
you didn't even know? Oh, wow.
No, none of that came out. None of that ever, like, was even in the works yet or anything.
And then we keep hearing about this other film that you have coming out called Our Friend John. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's actually just came out 3 weeks ago. It's a documentary really near and dear to my heart. Where I'm from, New Hampshire, I had a friend, John, who passed away from sickle cell anemia, really my brother's best friend. And before he died, he was writing a script for a horror film that he wanted to make with his friends, which he never got to actualize. And then upon his passing, they decided they were going to make it in his honor. And they all have disabilities themselves and made up this program that helped people with disabilities live more normal lives after high school, because for the most part, when it comes to disabilities, like most places in America, most states aren't equipped to do anything with people that have disabilities after high school. They kind of like fast track them on like a program that's not a college level program, so they have nowhere to go after, and they end up staying at home with a parent or guardian for the rest of their lives, not really having any kind of like outlet. And our state was lucky enough in New Hampshire to have this program called Living Innovations. And so each of them gets like an aide that takes them out and helps them, you know, meet more people that have similar problems, do normal things like go to bars and go to social gatherings and shop for themselves and find them employment and all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty genuine. So glad you're doing that for your friends and stuff. Well, Ed, you're the real deal, man. You know, we appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
If you want to support like a movie like Our Friend John, what can they do for you?
Well, right now it is on Vimeo on demand. You can watch the whole movie. I think it's like $1.99. It's on Roku TV. It's on Fire Stick TV. It's on Apple TV. And then in a few weeks, we're just waiting on Amazon to put it on Amazon Prime. There you have they have a backlog right now. It was supposed to be there on April 13th, so they have a little bit of a backlog because all their employees aren't there for coronavirus, but eventually you can also watch it there. And in the meantime, you can watch some of my other stuff. You just put Edward Payson into an Amazon search, a bunch of movies that I directed or contributed to will come up on there as well.
Nice.
All right, so tonight we're brought to you by Shudder. That's a premium video service brought to you by AMC Networks, offering an unbeatable selection of expertly curated supernatural thrillers, uncut and commercial-free with exclusive and original titles you're not going to find anywhere else. You can start your free trial today, risk-free. You can stream these thrillers and horror movies and suspense for only $5.99 a month. They're actually considered the Netflix for horror films. They got spine-tingling thrillers, edge-of-your-seat suspense that's added weekly. You're going to get unlimited access to that to stream ad-free on your favorite devices like your iPhone, your Apple TV, or your Roku device, or Roku, however you say that thing. They're not our sponsors, so it doesn't matter. Moving on, or your Google device. They also have a unique collection of exclusive and original films and horror classics. Like right now, they got like a Dario Argento collection, a horror comedy thing, classic slashers. When I was on there, I was really pleasantly surprised by a movie about a pizza delivery girl called Satanic Panic. I thought that was pretty entertaining. Also, the new Creepshow blows my mind. I mean, they brought it back, and one of my favorite stories was Finger, about this little monster that grows out of a finger. I don't want to give too much away. You'll have to check it out if you get on Shudder. And then, one of the best movies I've ever seen has been added as a Shudder exclusive. It's called Mandy. You should definitely check that out. What about you guys? You guys cruising through Shudder?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
just watch one this afternoon.
What'd you watch?
I watched one called Z, which is about a boy and his evil imaginary friend. Kind of take it. I'll let you go watch it yourself. And another good one on there is called One Cut of the Dead, which is a zombie movie that from Korea, I think. But that's worth a watch. I think that's another Shudder exclusive. That's pretty cool, man.
I watched Brain Dead, about a guy who picks up a parasite, an ancient parasite that eats people's brains and doses him with his brain with psychedelic visions, so he doesn't have to care about the fact that it's eating people.
Nice. So if you want to get
started,
yeah, and if you guys out there want to get started streaming the horror and thriller and supernatural content, you got Shudder's expertly curated collection, which includes titles like Tigers Are Not Afraid, as Dave said, One Cut of the Dead, Revenge, and the new Creepshow series that I mentioned a little while ago. If you want to try Shudder free for 30 days, go to Shudder.com and use our promo code BINGEWATCHERS. That's S-H-U-D-D-E-R, Shudder.com, and remember to use our promo code BINGEWATCHERS, which is the name of our show, so you should be able to figure it out and Shudder together and stay home and watch a bunch of horror films. Guys, speaking of horror films, let's rip into this thing called Mandy. How about that?
Holy cow.
Let's do it.
Sounds all right. Good.
The opening scroll, or text, if you will, in the beginning of the movie says, "When I die, bury me deep. Lay two speakers at my feet. Put some headphones on my head and rock and roll me when I'm dead." It appears to come from the final words of Douglas Roberts, a man convicted of kidnapping, robbery, and murder in Texas, who was executed on April 20th, 2005. Now, you would think it's like a quote from a rock band or something, but I had thought I had seen movies before Mandy. I haven't seen shit. A few years ago, yeah. I know, right? I feel like, I mean, I've watched thousands of movies, but when I saw this film, I was like, everything else that came before this doesn't even fucking matter anymore. You know, years ago, I don't know if you guys remember this. Maybe I didn't talk to you guys about this, but I was pitching one of my stories as like a whimsical horror movie. And now I'm like, dude, I got to set my sets higher, man. Like, Mandy puts my shit to shame. I got to fucking work harder. Dave, why don't you tell our listeners why they should like this movie? Just give them a little taste, because Dave's the one who pointed me in the direction of Mandy in the first place.
Well, I don't know, man. You choose any day, you know, you can choose any number of things. Is it the horror elements? Is it the cinematography? It's got one of the best Cage performances. Cage has kind of been killing it the last few years. He's kind of been making a comeback in movies like this and Color Out of Space. Nice. I don't know. How do you describe this movie, man? It has a tone. It has the color palette.
Nice.
It has demons. It has satanic cults. It has chainsaw fights.
We're about to go really deep on it, but let me just get the tagline in and then a little history on the filmmaker. So, some time ago in the 80s, a lumberjack and his girlfriend get attacked by drugged-out cult members. Now, the lumberjack, Red, goes on a quest after they mess with his lady, Mandy. Right, that's where the title comes from. And then it turns into this ferociously poetic masterpiece of utter darkness, dismay, and the eternal drive to right the wrongs. Now, the filmmaker has said that he was more interested in how stories are told than the stories themselves. He's actually quoted, there's a featurette on Shudder right now, like behind the scenes, and he's saying something to the tune of, he wants all his films to turn into pop art because he was only allowed to read magazines as a kid about horror movie stuff, and study, like, the poster art. So he was always, like, trying to guess what the movies were about based on the artwork. And, of course, I'm talking about Panos Cosmatos, who's kind of like filmmaking royalty. He may have earned his chops on his dad's movie Tombstone when he was just working as, like, a video assistant. The rumor is, or the story that goes around, or the legend behind this guy, is that he saved all of his royalties to finance his first feature, which is called Behind the Black Rainbow, which I guess is also cultish and kind of horror movie stuff, too. I haven't actually seen it, though. I might go back and investigate it now that I've seen his other movie, and now I want to find out more about this dude. But, Nick, what did his dad do, and in your opinion, what is his dad's best movie?
So his dad is George Cosmatos, and he's best known for Rambo Part 2, Cobra, which both starred Stallone, and the science fiction classic Leviathan, and the critically acclaimed Western Tombstone. And by the way, I freaking love Leviathan. Such a great filmmaker.
So do you think of that group of films, Leviathan's your favorite?
I think so. I don't know why. It just, yeah. And I can see some of that Leviathan in this movie, but not too much. But yeah.
Now, Dave, from that list, what do you think is George's best movie?
well, I mean, I have to go with Tombstone, but Yeah, that's my absolute favorite. I saw that in theaters. I love that movie. Although, small shout out to a movie that we actually covered on the show also, called Of Unknown Origin, which is a horror movie of its own about a guy going nuts trying to kill a rat.
Well, that one won a Raspberry Award. I kept it off this because we're talking about, like, what is critically acclaimed
for.
Oh,
no way.
It,
so. Well, the Raspberries have constantly got it wrong. They voted The Shining for the first year, so you can't really go by that.
All right. Did they really?
Yeah. Well, wow. Hey, it's a world of critics, folks. I don't know what to say.
Yes.
Adam, what do you think from this list? Rambo 2, Cobra, Leviathan, Tombstone. What are your thoughts?
You're a daisy if you do. Tombstone. All day long.
Tombstone. All right. Oh, man. You know, some people like Wyatt Earp more than they like Tombstone. Just going to put that out
there. No. Are you kidding me? Tombstone is one that
you're like, who?
Who likes Wyatt Earp more than Tombstone? No, I don't know.
Kevin Costner fans. People that have not seen Tombstone are the people that like
That's ridiculous.
All right. Let's not get too sidetracked because we'll spend all night talking about Tombstone versus Wyatt Earp. Let's get back to Mandy. So I think in a single movie, Panos actually, he's learned from his dad, but I think he surpasses, in my opinion, I think he surpasses his dad as a filmmaker. I don't know if you guys agree.
Wow.
He has more to, well, his dad was definitely more of a pop or mainstream film director. Panos is definitely on his own level. He's definitely, I like that quote you mentioned, he's definitely an artist, or he strives for art.
Mandy has won a ton of awards. For instance, it's pretty much won every major award in 2019 at the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards. We're talking about Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting, Best Effects. Then they go on to win an Indie Spirit Award for Best Cinematography. They also show up at the Saturn Awards, which is like a science fiction award. They get Best Film and Best Actor. And then also they get Best Score and Best Stunts. Literally, it's a laundry list that just keeps going and going and going for this movie. Now, it sounds like we're circle jerking, but whatever. Now we're going to go to first impressions. Nick, first impression of Mandy.
Okay, the first 15 minutes, I fell asleep. Like, the first time I watched it, right? Then the next night, I gave it another chance. Once you get past that, I mean, once you get used to this director's style, and once they get into the meat of this movie, holy cow, does this just – I was blown away.
Or everybody's meat because they chop people to pieces.
Yeah.
No, you're right. It's the first I clocked it. I was tracking it because I was like, it is a sleeper in the beginning.
Slow.
It's 34 minutes. Like, you have to get to minute 34, and then somebody gets burned alive, and then the shit hits the fan after that. But Dave, first impressions.
I saw this when it first came out a few years ago. I've seen it 3 times now.
Wow.
Which I can't say that of any movie in the last 5 years. I just loved it. The cinematography well deserved all of its awards. It's got an interesting color palette. I've never taken acid, but I have to imagine this might be kind of what that feels like. It's a very trippy, great Cage performance. You know, the music is also another great aspect of this movie that I love.
For sure, yeah.
It's I don't agree. I guess I can see the argument of the first 15 minutes being slow, but I don't know. I just kind of, I'm lulled into this world. I actually want to live in this world minus the demons and the killing.
I think next time I watch it, I'll be able to, like, now that I know what I'm in for, I will appreciate those first 15 minutes.
Right.
I just think the first time I was like, what the hell? But don't get me wrong. Watch it. It's great.
I can see that. Like, I won't argue against that, but I don't know. I was lulled in from the beginning.
Well, I didn't want to I didn't want to spoil any part of this movie for you guys.
Short correction.
Correction.
If you have watched this movie, then you have taken acid.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, I know.
Anyway.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Adam chimed in, and then I was trying to say, like, I was trying very hard, like, when I wanted to tell you guys to, like, when you watch this, like, really pay attention to it, avoid distractions and, like, give it your full attention, because it's one of those movies, like, you have to see it a certain way, right? And I watched it twice because I was like, okay, you know, big screen TV and then, like, the bedroom TV, and I was, like, literally, like, didn't want to have, like, divided attention, right? You know what I mean? Like, I could tell it was a movie that you have to pay attention to, but that swings me back around to Adam now, because, I mean, you kind of maybe said your first impressions already, but if you have anything to add, you know, about, like, initially going into the movie.
Well, I tried to watch it with a friend, and nothing was happening for so long that he was sitting there complaining and trashing it, so I had to turn it off and watch it alone later. And I'm so glad that I watched it without any, like, any naysaying around, because I was really able to immerse. And right at that 15-minute mark, now for you, it was 34 minutes, but me, right after 15 minutes, I started to see the pieces starting to come together, and I got excited about where it was going.
Yeah.
And this weird troop of people that see her on the road are like, oh, I think I know what that is.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's weird stuff going on with this group of people, and it started to suck me in. I didn't realize that they were willing to go as far as they did, and the way that it just unrolled, the way it unrolled was like in real life, where like you're on an adventure and shit gets real. I don't know, like what you guys have to pull from in that regard, but
well, it sounds like setting the tone with the couple. It sounds like it was turning people off until this moment where the story begins to shift, and then you see what the movie's really about. But I mean, he's trying to tell a story and do a setup appropriate way, and I think, like, you know, we're all kind of damned by the lack of attention span that we have. But if we were sitting in a theater 20 years ago, we probably would have gone along with it no problem, and we would have been enthralled by it. You know, that's just
Deer Hunter.
Yeah, something like that. Now let's talk about like specific scenes. Like you mentioned Deer Hunter, which is a pretty traumatic film, but there's some traumatic shit in this movie too. I'm talking about The Burning. Like
that was hard to watch.
Well, like the fact that they put a person up in a sleeping bag in a tree, and then the person who's in, you know, a person who cares about that individual is powerless to do anything about it or to change what's about to happen. And what's weird is if you're really watching the movie, like I said, you have to be distraction free, because if someone comes in and interrupts you watching this movie, you're not going to be there with the characters. But if you're really if you're really watching the movie and giving it any kind of attention, when that happens, you're fucking feeling it. You're right there with these people, and then after that, you've accepted what this movie's going to do. And then you're not just on the ride, like you're it's like a first person experience. You are with Red, you are in his mind, you guys were talking about acid trips, like you are mentally absorbed into this movie, and then you're with this guy for like what's about to unravel. And then we're meeting like human Cenobites, and Cenobites, folks, if you haven't seen Hellraiser, they're the Hellraisers.
Yes.
Like demons that come out of a puzzle box. But in this movie, human Cenobites, like they're permafried trippers called the Black Skulls, who've gotten like a bad batch of heroin or something from a guy called the Chemist, which we meet him later, who's really just like a gatekeeper. Like, what's cool about this movie is it follows like the Joseph Campbell mythological like hero's journey. Like later on, there's gonna be like a whole bunch of stuff that relates to like the innermost cave and a mentor and even an elixir, right? Because Red at some point in this movie has a jar, which is like the elixir that gets him tripping like the villains, so he can get to their level that he needs to be at to deal with them. But I mean, like, they even have a scene where the hero is literally forging a weapon for the quest. You know what I mean?
Like, I love that scene.
I mean, again, we say like he's this outdoorsy guy who lives in the woods in these mountains. In the movie, it says the Shadow Mountains, that's all bullshit made up. But the fact that he's in his garage or whatever, his little workshop, and he's like melting metal down to make a fucking axe to go get revenge and slay the monsters, which are humans, that's more terrifying. Like the fact that the Hellraisers in this movie are people that want to act demonic. That's, to me, that's much scarier than demons that might pop out of hell, is a human being willing to put on the skin of a demon and act like a demon and do terrible things to other humans. That's fucking scary as shit, brothers. That's some scary fucking shit, man. Scary.
For sure.
Yeah.
Crazy clues there about how they get along, too. It seems like they're just parasites. They just go on to some isolated cabin and do whatever the heck they want to whoever and take over for a while and then move on.
Yeah, you're right. They just absorb something, and then once the resources are exhausted, you're right, they move on to the next thing. But when he's trying to figure out what the deal is with these people, he goes and visits Red goes and visits like what might be his mentor buddy, like an old Marine, like maybe they're in the service together or something. I kind of get the feeling like they know each other from a previous life or lifestyle, right? I think the actor's name is Bill Duke, but he's from The Predator.
Bill fucking Duke, yeah.
Yeah. And is this not the greatest cameo of all time, Nick?
It's so good, dude.
Incredible. Like,
I haven't seen him in forever, yeah.
Yeah.
Damn.
Because, like I love him in –
he's beautiful.
Like, between, like, Predator, like John mentioned, and Commando, like, this guy was everywhere in the 80s. Like, he was, like, one
Action Jackson.
Yeah.
Nice, you know, it's crazy, dude. Look him up, though. Like, in addition to being an actor, he has like a shit ton of directing credits. He's like he's directed a shit ton.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I know he does like a lot of film school related stuff, and he helps a lot of younger people get started. And he's like on these, like, go to YouTube, like you can see like his master class with Bill Duke. It's kind of cool.
Oh, really?
Nice. Yeah, kind of that kind of stuff. But it was just great to see him. I didn't know he was still doing anything really. But you'll listen to his wisdom. You'll take it for sure. And then, like, in that same scene, Nick Cage is like unraveling, and he's like as red, and he goes something like, "It's crazy evil, man. I got to deal with crazy evil." And he's like trying to express to his friend, "You don't get it, man. Like, you don't get it. You know what I mean?" Like, he's like, you know, and he's like, "Well, you're not coming back from this." And then, you know, then he takes his little Bronco, which is like seems like a special car, and he's going to do things with it. And then he makes a couple mistakes. I couldn't believe that he gets caught in the monster's lair again. Like, he barely got out of it before, and then he's stuck there again.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
That's a great scene.
He tried to do something, and then, you know.
Jacked up right in the first, like, yeah.
Yeah. So, I want to talk about best death scenes. Dave, what is the best death in the movie?
Oh, God. Probably the cult leader with the sword you mentioned, and just going right into the guy's throat, his mouth, spits blood all over fucking Nicolas Cage.
Oh, you're talking about the lieutenant. He's not the leader. He's like the right hand man. You're talking
That's
about
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He catches up.
Yeah, where
yeah.
he just like shoves it in his mouth and just. Whoa.
And yeah. what the hell guess. Was that guy watching on TV? Holy cow.
Are you talking about the horror?
Cheddar Goblin?
Oh, wait. Oh, wait. When he comes back to his house after the brutality, and then, like, he, there is a commercial in the movie for, like, a mac and cheese product called the Cheddar Goblin, which is incredible. Yeah. I wish it existed. Everybody would buy it at the store. They should make the Cheddar Goblin, like, a Funko Pop doll or something. That'd be really fun. But, Nick, you're what? What, Adam?
Made me hungry.
Oh, yeah, it made everybody hungry. That's like if I see pizza in a movie, it doesn't matter what movie it is, and it's like, oh, shit, I gotta make a pizza. All right, Nick, what is your favorite death scene in the movie? We're talking about horror films, folks, so we gotta examine the murder. I mean, that's part of it.
The chainsaw death.
Oh, the chainsaw fight. Yeah.
Great. So I thought that was really
it's
cool
like a super elaborate chainsaw fight. The only more elaborate chainsaw fight might be in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. But the chainsaw fight in this movie is pretty intense. But
it's crazy. But
I mean, like, Red gets so many chances. Like, the fact that he puts down his little axe and then goes for a chainsaw that he doesn't even he doesn't know any, like, that's not his chainsaw. Like, not the one he uses at work. He has no idea if it has any gasoline in it or anything. Like, and then obviously it's not working right away, and the tension's racking up because you're like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen here. Like, there's no, all bets are off. He keeps getting captured by all the monster people. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't, we don't know. And that brings me to Adam. Put us on a clear path here. What is your favorite death in the movie?
Mandy stole the show. That was an amazing death scene.
Wow. I mean, technically he's not wrong. It's just the most gut-punching one.
It's the worst.
So Adam gets the gold ribbon tonight, folks, or the bloody ribbon. Yeah, it should be a red ribbon. He gets the prize for spoiling it. I didn't even tell you that Mandy was the one who burnt alive. Like, Adam just said, Mandy's the best. Like,
well, I didn't say how she died, did I?
I don't know. Maybe I fucked it up.
It's out of the bag now. No, Mandy lives. Okay.
Yeah.
So, the best death scene is the guy where Nicolas Cage has already dealt with, like, his captor, and he's walking around in the house. And there's this big coked up behemoth when he's still normal. He hasn't touched the elixir and he gets tossed around and he ends up being able to kill the guy almost on accident. Like, obviously he wants to kill the guy, but his ability to do so is compromised because this guy's beefy and huge and the guy's, you know, throws his weight on him and ends up killing himself.
Well, the big guy, as you described as the behemoth, he gets his metal dick, knife dick, stuck in the floor.
And what the hell was that thing? Wow.
I don't know, but did you see the quick shot of the old couple that owned the house? Like, he clearly did something to them with that contraption. You know what I mean?
Like the butt was all bloody or something, yeah.
I was going to leave it up to the imagination, but Nick wanted to tell you exactly what it was. That scene, that scenario, that's where they have the elixir because he drinks the infected heroin And then, like, the innermost cave is probably the underground church where he's got to have, like, the boss fight, or what we think is going to be a boss fight. Do you guys agree with the script devices that are being used in this movie? The innermost cave, the hero's journey, all that shit?
I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that impresses me about this movie is we talk about how complex it is, but if you talk about just plot, just simple plot, it's the simplest of plots, really.
Yeah.
But it's got so many other details and layers going on.
Well, that's what Panos said. I mean, that's what he meant. Like, if you watch that featurette that Shudder has, was like, he was saying that not what the story is, but how you tell it. Like, how you arrive at these places with these characters, you know what I mean, is like, more important.
We've seen this story, like, in Death Wish or whatever 100 times.
Yeah.
Like, but,
yeah.
But the way he did it was, I felt like I was watching something I've never seen before.
Hmm. All right.
For sure.
So let's talk about the cult for a minute. Let's talk about the cult leader. What do we think about Jeremiah? Adam?
Jeremiah was certainly one of the creepiest on-screen villains that I've ever seen in a film. It was so impressive. His ability to really go there. A total narcissist. And everybody else was going along with him. His ultimate in narcissism and murderous psychopathy, and what he brought to the role, like, he was fragile in places, but then he was like stern and making sure that he kept his people in line, and you just got to see the dynamics of how everyone related to each other. And then there was like the girl that was pretty much being used in a prisoner, and I don't know, just there's so many. And then there's the old needy woman, and just how it all broke down, and, you know, having faithful troops.
Hmm.
Yeah, wow.
Nick, what do you...
Interesting hierarchy.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Nick, what do you want to add to that?
I totally agree with him, and I think everything Adam said, I totally agree with. And there was a scene, actually, where he looked in the mirror and was, like, questioning himself, and that just shows, like, he was a vulnerable villain, but when he needed to be strong, he was strong. He scared the shit out of me in this movie. One of the best villains I've seen in years, to be honest.
Do you know he's like one of the original actors from the first Law & Order show?
No way, really?
Yeah.
I'm going to Google this. Wow.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Oh, man. And talk about a brave performance by this guy. Like, getting just butt naked. Like, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
And getting laughed at being naked.
I know. Oh, my gosh. I know. Like, that's some balls.
Oh.
Well, I mean, that's a major plot device, that he can't win over, you know, the woman that he kidnapped and drugged and tried to manipulate into believing the fantasy. You know, he couldn't. And then we obviously know what that leads to. But I guess that swings around to Dave. What do you think about Jeremiah?
I mean, he's kind of simultaneously creepy as shit and also a joke.
Hmm.
You know, especially with, you know, we're talking about Mandy laughing at him. I mean, his music shit. He's like, he's a wannabe Charles Manson, but he's at least found a core group of people that are still willing to follow him. Creepy performance, though. I mean, I can't get that image of where he's talking to Mandy, and like, they keep with the editing, they keep fusing his face into hers and back to him, like him trying to become one with her, but he can't. At least that's the way I interpreted it.
Oh, that thing they stabbed into her neck, that hornet thing, that's a real thing. It's called like a hawk wasp. That thing is real.
Yeah. Oh, shit. I've seen the... Those things, you don't want to fuck with those. I've seen them in person.
So do you guys think this is one of the best cult movies, or is there a better cult leader like in another movie? What do you think, Dave?
I'm sure there's better cult leaders in terms of, you know, actually being successful or something. He's unique. I mean, he is creepy as shit.
Hmm.
I think he was meant to be taken as a joke. I mean, but except with his core group of people, like that's my interpretation.
Oh, you're saying like he managed to drug and trick like seven people, but that's
I guess what I'm saying is like the filmmaker clearly took a stance of like, this guy, he's scary, but he's really a joke. Like, if you really tear
but,
down.
But isn't he suggesting that's the core of all cult leaders, right?
Fair enough. Yeah, true.
I don't know, Adam. You got anything to add to that one?
Nope.
All right, Nick, you want to chime in? Or are we gonna move
on? Would you consider the guy from Indiana Jones Temple of Doom, the guy who pulls the thing out of the heart, a cult leader?
Oh, that's a good. I don't know. They might be a legitimate registered nonprofit 503 organization in that movie.
Don't take my pick, Nick.
I'm just saying, when I was a kid, that stuff jacked me up. So
The heart.
Well, hell, then if we're going to expand it out, we'll just say, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master, if you want to go after something like that.
Oh, geez.
I'm just saying.
Wow. Oh, wow. Man. Man.
Tom Cruise wants to sponsor this podcast now.
You know who was like a cult leader in the making is Jim Carrey's character in The Cable Guy. I could see him taking over like a little organization of like TV people, you know. But okay, so now let's really think about our final thoughts about this movie.
Well, I had a pick.
You had a what? A pick for a cult leader?
Yeah, I got a pick for a cult.
Well,
leader.
We've already moved on. I gave you a chance. You weren't with it.
I mean, I wasn't first here, so I thought I was second. But anyway, 12 Monkeys, Brad Pitt, leader of the 12 Monkeys.
Yeah,
that's a good choice.
That's pretty good, actually. Yeah, which is anybody knows 12 Monkeys is based on a French thing called La Jetée. They forced that down our throats in film school. Actually, they made us watch La Jetée like over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. Watch these stills.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You could might say all film schools are cults. Actually,
there's a lot of they're not accredited.
All right, Adam, since you're talking so much on this episode, what are your final thoughts of Mandy?
I just wanted to say a couple words about one is my favorite line from the movie. And it's not "you rip my shirt," it was
"blood for blood."
I like, as soon as I heard that guy like talk like that, I didn't know what kind of movie I was watching. Where are we going with this?
Oh, where is this movie going?
Yeah. And the other thing is the soundtrack is absolutely amazing and immersive. It was from a guy named Johan Johansson. Unfortunately, he has passed away. This was posthumously released. And the soundtrack is beautiful. It is something else, and it definitely... is a gigantic aid to this movie being so successful and be able to pull people in like it is. So kudos goes out and rest in peace to the composer.
Oh yeah, this was his final film according to all the articles that I read.
It's a beautiful score.
Yeah, it's incredible. Dave, what are your final thoughts on this one?
You know, I think this is a great bridge between what's been going on in the last 4 or 5 years, which is like the art house horror movie. I think this kind of bridges the gap between art house horror and exploitation and a beautiful marriage. It has, you know, Beetle, like this guy, the guy behind the camera, clearly it has more going on than just like, let's have shock value. Like, let's also like make it beautiful. Like, you know, I just love somebody taking this much thought into an exploitation movie, essentially, which is something that's very rare. So, go see it.
and
I second the soundtrack. If you have a great stereo system, it's a fucking great surround sound experience, like with the music and everything. It's like he really thinks everything out between the visuals and the sound.
Wow. Well, Nick is like Mr. Soundtrack, so I don't know if you're going to jump on the soundtrack on this one or if you had any other thoughts.
These guys already did that. I only have two things to say. One would be the cinematography is freaking incredible. This movie looks beautiful with the reds and the tones. Mm-hmm. And like, there's parts where like a guy's driving and they like probably put a bunch of red light behind so it hits the trees. I've never seen anything like that. I'm like, why do people not do
that? Yes, I was looking at that too, right?
Like, what?
It's just a simple shot of driving down a country road, like, but you're right, it did pop out.
Put some red lights on the trees, and it just makes everything just – the colors just pop. And then my second thing is I watched this movie 2 days ago, and I'm still thinking about that. And how many movies you watch that you just like, you're like, oh, that was a good movie, and then you don't think about it, right? This movie has been haunting me.
Well, like I said, for sure. Beautiful. I've seen this 3 times now, and it's and like John said, I've seen it 3 times, and this the third time I watched it today, and I'm still catching new shit in it. It's very layered.
This is a very haunting movie, and I fucking love it.
Well, I mean, it would be great if our audience actually like took a look at this movie and then like, you know, emailed us or posted back to us what they thought. I'd really love to hear people's interpretation of this movie, because all I really want to say in my final thoughts is almost every character in the movie says literally, "This is a dream." At the end of the movie, he's driving out of one of her paintings. He hallucinates about her. I'm really convinced that Red died when they stabbed him. I think he's dead. I think his whole quest is like his brain dying, and this is his like last fantasy of going to get revenge for his girlfriend or fiance or whoever Mandy was to him. But literally, I mean, he, like I said, one of the major clues is almost literally every character, at least four or five of them, says this is a dream. And then, as I said, he's driving out of the painting towards the end of the movie, right? So I mean, unless I'm like really off base here, I think maybe it's suggestive. It might be open-ended, but I really think they're suggesting that when they're talking about, you know, religious sacrifices and he gets stabbed, I don't think he ever got off the thing that he was barbed wired to. I don't think Red is alive.
I think I'd like to add a little bit here. I think he was crucified, and that when they stabbed him underneath the rib cage, it was just like when they stabbed Christ underneath the rib cage and broke the heart or whatever, and the blood flew out. I mean, that's a biblical.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then the whole movie then is it could be a brain thing. It could be a resurrection and a resurrection / revenge. Revenge erection. No, that doesn't sound good.
Did you say erection?
I mean, I mean, and then I didn't know. I did not know that George C. Scott was in a haunted house type movie called The Changeling. Yeah. Apparently, my boys here on the Binge Watchers crew know about this movie. But next week we're going to be talking about Changeling. We're going to review that movie. So stay tuned for that, folks. Another great show for you. I had a hell of a time. But I think Nick is going to say I had such a good time because of these bang energies that I've had. 1.5 so far.
John is on a roll.
Finding new flavors with those, by the way.
Oh yeah, I tried the most millennial of all, Froze Rose. Right?
I actually like that one.
Do you?
Oh, really?
Fight me.
Fight you?
I really like that one.
It's like a rosé wine. If they were trying to make a rosé into an energy drink, then bang, turned in one.
I know you like the cotton candy. My wife loves it, but I can't stand the cotton candy one.
See, and then Adam said he liked unicorn. The one I can't stand is unicorn, actually.
See, I can't stand that one either.
Sugar Rush.
Although this is not an advertisement for Bang, all if they want.
No, no way, shape, or form. But you know what? We've said this word probably a million times and like get over it already, but if you like horror movies, you can try out Shudder.com with our promo code BingeWatchers. That'd be something. And also, thanks to our guest, Edward Payson, for coming on and talking about his career in horror and TV and stuff like that. That was pretty awesome.
And, such a cool guy.
Yeah, and then next week, we'll be here for The Changeling. So, everybody, good night from the Binge Watchers, and we'll see you next time. Same podcast channel. I don't know. We're like everywhere. I don't even know where to tell them to go. Oh, our website. That'd be good. That'd be good, right? That'd be good. We have one. You should go there.
Yeah. Oh, BWPodcast.com.
Yeah, nice. Or,
and then go to if you're Shudder, subscribe with BingeWatchers.com and watch Mandy.
Nice.
Or next totally week's movie, Mandy. The Changeling, ahead of time.
Yeah, get ahead of us. That's the thing. That's
watch
why
all the things, dude. Like, I mean, you're going to become a subscriber after the trial. You're going to say, "I'm going to pay for it because it's that great." I do.
I'm sold.
Yeah.
I've been paying for it since October.
I'm addicted to it.
It is a good platform. I like the live channels where it shows.
Oh,
like,
hell yeah. I mean, you don't know what to watch?
Yeah, yeah. It's previewing.
It's so cool.
I'm actually kind of overwhelmed. Like, we're not doing the advertisement anymore, folks. This is just like legit. Like, just being a movie fan, I'm overwhelmed when I get on there because I, like, there's so much stuff. Like, I feel like I'm gonna pop a vein or something in my head because I don't know where to go.
Especially if you're a horror fan, I mean, it has everything.
Well, especially their original stuff. Like, I keep stumbling onto their original content. They put out really great shit that just doesn't get distribution over here. Like that One Cut of the Dead. Like, seriously, that's a great fucking movie.
Oh, that's like the zombie movie from the Philippines or something, right?
Yeah, like, I won't say much about it because I kind of went in somewhat blind, and the less you know about it, the better.
The less you know about us, the better, so we don't get sued by the IRS either, folks. There's no money. There's no money here. Just people watching movies. Just people watching movies. You know,
yeah, we're splitting 50 cents.
We are. If you talk about our, if you talk about stars, that's literally what. Yeah, exactly. Oh man, killer episode, fellas. Yeah.